Now, Sandy.
And that time I didn't say anything, just went along like a good boy. My throat was as dry as an old chip. I looked at my watch and wasn't exactly surprised to see that over an hour had gone by. Well, that was all right. I was off duty. The day was murkier than ever, but the faint mutters of thunder had slid away south of us. "Those old days," someone said, sounding both sad and amused at the same time. "It's a trick only the Jews and the Irish seem to manage with any grace. We thought we'd strut forever, didn't we?" I glanced around and saw Huddy Royer, now dressed in civilian clothes, sitting on Ned's left. I don't know when he joined us. He had the same honest Farmer John face he'd worn through the world back in 79, but now there were lines bracketing the corners of his mouth. His hair was mostly gray, and it had gone out like the tide, revealing a long, bright expanse of brow. He was, I judged, about the same age Ennis Rafferty had been when Ennis pulled his Judge Crater Act. Huddy's retirement plans involved a Winnebago and visits to his children and grandchildren. He had them everywhere, so far as I could make out, including the province of Manitoba. If you asked, and even if you didn't, he'd show you a U.S. map with all his proposed routes of travel marked in red. "Yeah," I said, "I guess we did at that."
"When did you arrive, Huddy?"
"Oh, I was passing by and heard you talking about Mr. Dillon. He was a good old doggy, wasn't he? Remember how he'd roll over on his back if anyone said, 'You're under arrest?'"
"Yeah," I said, and we smiled at each other the way men do over love or history.
"What happened to him?" Ned asked.
"Punched his card," Huddy said. "Eddie Jackaboy and I buried him right over there."
He pointed towards the scrubby field that stretched up a hill north of the barracks.
"Must be 15 years ago, wouldn't you say, Sandy?"
I nodded. It was actually 14 years, almost to the day. "I guess he was old, huh?" Ned asked.
"Phil Candleton said, 'Getting up there, yes, but—'"
"He was poisoned," Huddy said in a rough, outraged voice, and then said no more.
"If you want to hear the rest of the story," I began.
"I do," Ned replied at once.
"Then I'll need to wet my whistle."
I started to get up just as Shirley came out with a tray in her hands. On it was a plate of thick sandwiches, ham and cheese, roast beef, chicken, and a big pitcher of Red Zinger iced tea.
"Sit back down, Sandy," she said. "I got you covered."
"What are you, a mind reader?" She smiled as she set the tray down on the bench.
"Nope. I just know that men get thirsty when they talk and that men are always hungry. Even the ladies get hungry and thirsty from time to time, believe it or not. Eat up, you guys, and I expect you to put away at least two of these sandwiches yourself, Ned Wilcox. You're too damn thin."
Looking at the loaded tray made me think of B.B. Roth talking with Tony and Edis while his crew, his children, not much older than Ned was now, drank iced tea and gobbled sandwiches made in the same kitchenette. Nothing different except the color of the tiles on the floor and the microwave oven. Time is also held together by chains, I think.
"Yes, ma'am. Okay."
He gave her a smile, but I thought it was dutiful rather than spontaneous. He kept looking over at Shed B. He was under the spell of the thing now, as so many men had been over the years, not to mention one good dog. And as I drank my first glass of iced tea, cold and good going down my parched throat, loaded with real sugar rather than that unsatisfying artificial shit, I had time to wonder if I was doing Ned Wilcox any favors, or if he'd even believe the rest of it. He might just get up and walk away all stiff-shouldered and angry, believing I'd been making a game of him and his grief. It wasn't impossible. Huddy, Arky, and Phil would back me up. So would Shirley, for that matter. She hadn't been around when the Buick came in, but she'd seen plenty and done plenty since taking the dispatch job in the mid-80s. The kid still might not believe it, though. It was a lot to swallow.
"Too late to back out now, though."
"What happened about Trooper Rafferty?" Ned asked.
"Nothing," Huddy said.
It didn't even get his ugly mug on the side of a milk carton.
Ned gazed at him uncertainly, not sure if Huddy was joking or not.
Nothing happened, Huddy repeated more quietly this time. That's the insidious thing about disappearing, son. What happened to your dad was terrible, and I'd never try to convince you any different. But at least you know. That's something, isn't it? There's a place where you can go and visit, where you can lay down flowers or take your college acceptance letter.
That's just a grave you're talking about, Ned said. He spoke with a strange patience that made me uneasy. There's a piece of ground, there's a box under it, and there's something in the box that's dressed in my father's uniform, but it's not my father.
But you know what happened to him, Huddy insisted. With Ennis, he spread his hands with the palms down, then turned them up like a magician at the end of a good trick. Archie had gone inside, probably to take a leak. Now he came back and sat down.
All quiet? I asked.
Well, yes and no, Sarge. Steph told me to tell you she's getting those bursts of interference on the radio again, those little short ones. You know what I mean? Also, DSS is kaputnik. Just that sign on the TV screen that says stand by. Steph was Stephanie Colucci, Shirley's second-shift replacement in dispatch and old Andy Colucci's niece. The DSS was our little satellite dish, paid for out of our own pockets like the exercise equipment in the corner upstairs. A year or two ago, someone tacked a poster to the wall beside the free weights showing buff biker types working out in the prison yard up at Shabine. They never take a day off, is the punchline beneath. Archie and I exchanged a glance, then looked over at Shed B. If the microwave oven in the kitchenette wasn't on the fritz now, it soon would be. We might lose the lights and the phone, too, although it had been a while since that had happened. We took up a collection for that rotten old bitch he was married to, Huddy said. That was mighty big of Troop D, in my view.
I thought it was to shut her up, Phil said.
Wasn't nothing going to shut that one up, Huddy said. She meant to have her say. Anyone who ever met her knew that. It wasn't exactly a collection, and he wasn't married to her, I said. The woman was his sister. I thought I made that clear. He was married to her, Huddy insisted. They were like an old couple, with all the yaps and grumps and sore places. They did everything married folks do except for the old in-out, and for all I know it.
Snip, snip, bite your lip, Shirley said mildly.
Yeah, Huddy said, I suppose. Tony passed the hat, and we all tossed in as much as we could, I told Ned. Then Buck Flanders' brother, he's a stockbroker in Pittsburgh, invested it for her. It was Tony's idea to do it that way rather than just hand her a check. Huddy was nodding. He brought it up at that meeting, he called, the one in the back room at the Countryway. Taking care of the dragon was just about the last item on the agenda. Huddy turned directly to Ned. By then we knew nobody was going to find Ennis, and that Ennis wasn't just going to walk into a police station somewhere in Bakersfield, California, or Nome, Alaska, with a case of amnesia from a knock on the head. He was gone. Maybe to the same place the fella in the black coat and hat went off to. Maybe to some other place, but gone either way. There was no body, no signs of violence, not even any clothes, but Ennie was gone. Huddy laughed. It was a sour sound. Oh, that bad-natured bitch he lived with was so wild. Of course she was half crazy to begin with. More than half, Archie said complacently and helped himself to a ham and cheese sandwich. She called all the time, 3-4 times a day, made Matt Bibicki and dispatched just about Terror's hair out. You should count your blessings she's gone, Shirley. Eat at times. What a piece of work.
What did she think had happened? Ned asked.
Who knows, I said. That we killed him over poker debts, maybe, and buried him in the cellar.
You played poker in the barracks back then? Ned looked both fascinated and horrified. Did my father play?
Oh, please, I said. Tony would have scalped anyone he caught playing poker in the barracks, even for matches. And I'd do exactly the same. I was joking. We're not firemen, boy, Huddy said with such disdain that I had to laugh. Then he returned to the subject at hand. That old woman believed we had something to do with it because she hated us. She would have hated anyone that distracted Ennis's attention from her. Is hate too strong a word, Sarge?
No, I said. Huddy once more turned to Ned.
We took his time and we took his energy, and I think the part of Ennis's life that was the best for him was the part he spent here, or in his cruiser. And she knew that, and she hated it. The job, the job, the job, she'd say. That's all he cares about, his damn job. As far as she was concerned, we must have taken his life. Didn't we take everything else?
Ned looked bewildered, perhaps because hate of the job had never been a part of his own home life. Not that he'd seen, anyway. Shirley laid a gentle hand on his knee. She had to hate somebody, don't you see? She had to blame somebody.
Ned looked pale and thoughtful. Maybe a few hateful thoughts had crossed his own mind. Surely it had occurred to him that if not for the gray uniform, his dad would still be alive.
I said, Edith called, Edith hectored us. Edith wrote letters to her congressman and to the state attorney general demanding a full investigation. I think Tony knew all that was in the offing, but he went right ahead with the meeting we had a few nights later and laid out his proposal to take care of her. If we didn't, he said, no one would. Ennis hadn't left much, and without our help, she'd be next door to destitute. Ennis had insurance and was eligible for his pension, probably 80% of full by then, but she wouldn't see a penny of either one for a long time because he just disappeared, Ned said.
Right.
So we got up a subscription for the Dragon, a couple of $1,000 all told, with troopers from Lawrence and Beaver and Mercer also chipping in. Buck Flanders' brother put it in computer stocks, which were brand new then, and she ended up making a small fortune. As for Ennis, a story started going around the various troops over here in western PA that he'd run off to Mexico. He was always talking about Mexico and reading magazine stories about it. Pretty soon it was being taken as gospel. Ennis had run away from his sister before she could finish the job of cutting him up with that Ginzu knife tongue of hers. Even guys who knew better, or should have, started telling that story after a while. Guys who were in the back room of the Country Way when Tony Shane Dinks said right out loud that he believed the Buick in Shed B had something to do with Ennis' disappearance.
Stop just short of calling it a transporter unit from Planet X, Huddy said.
Sarge was very forceful that night, Archie said, sounding so much like Lawrence Welk. Now here's the lovely Alice Sunlan, that I had to raise my hand to cover a smile. When she wrote her congressman, I guess she didn't talk about what you guys had over there in the Twilight Zone, did she? Ned asked.
How could she? I asked.
She didn't know. That was the main reason Sergeant Shane Dinks called the meeting. Basically, it was to remind us that loose lips sink sh...
What's that? Ned asked, half rising from the bench.
I didn't even have to look to know what he was seeing, but of course I looked anyway. So did Shirley, Archie, and Huddy. You couldn't not look, couldn't not be fascinated. None of us had ever pissed and howled over the roadmaster like poor old Mr. D, but on at least two occasions I had screamed. Oh, yes. I had damn near screamed my guts out, and the nightmares afterward. Man, oh, man. The storm had gone away to the south of us, except in a way it hadn't. In a way, it had been caged up inside of Shed B. From where we sat on the smoker's bench, we could see bright, soundless explosions of light going off inside. The row of windows in the roll-up door would be as black as pitch, and then they'd turn blue-white, and with each flash I knew the radio and dispatch would give out another bray of static. Instead of showing 5:18 p.m., the clock on the microwave would be reading error. But on the whole, this wasn't a bad one. The flashes of light left after images, greenish squares that floated in front of your eyes, but you could look. The first three or four times that pocket storm happened, looking was impossible. It would have fried your eyes right out of your head. "Holy God!" Ned whispered. His face was long with surprise. No, that's too timid. It was shock I saw on his face that afternoon. Nor was shock the end of it. When his eyes cleared a little, I saw the same look of fascination I had seen on his father's face, on Tony's, Huddy's, Matt Bibicki's, and Phil Candleton's. And hadn't I felt it on my own face? It's how we most often appear when we confront the deep and authentic unknown, I think. When we glimpse that place where our familiar universe stops and the real blackness begins. Ned turned to me. "Sandy, Jesus Christ, what is it? What is it?" "If you have to call it something, call it a light quake, a mild one. These days, most of them are mild. You want a closer look?" He didn't ask if it was safe, didn't ask if it was going to explode in his face or bake the old sperm factory down below. He just said, "Yeah," which didn't surprise me in the least. We walked over, Ned and I in the lead, the others not far behind. The irregular flashes were very clear in the gloom of the late day, but they registered on the eye even in full sunshine. And when we first took possession, that was right around the time Three Mile Island almost blew, now that I think about it, the Buick Roadmaster in one of its throws literally outshone the sun. "Do I need shades?" Ned asked as we approached the shed door. I could now hear the humming from inside, the same hum Ned's father had noticed as he sat behind the Buick's oversized wheel out at the Jenny station. "Nah, just squint," Huddy said. "You would have needed shades in 79, though, I can tell you that." "You bet your sweet ass," Arky said as Ned put his face to one of the windows, squinting and peering in. I slotted myself in next to Ned, fascinated as always. "Step right up. See the living crocodile." The Roadmaster stood entirely revealed. The tarp it had somehow shrugged off, lying crumpled in a tan drift on the driver's side. To me it looked more like an object d'art than ever. That big old automotive dinosaur with its curvy lines and hardtop styling, its big wheels and sneer-mouth grill. "Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this evening's viewing of From a Buick 8. Just keep a respectful distance, because this is art that bites." It sat there moveless and dead. And then the cabin lit up a brilliant flashbulb purple. The oversized steering wheel and the rearview mirror stood out with absolute dark clarity, like objects on the horizon during an artillery barrage. Ned gasped and put up a hand to shield his face. It flashed again and again, each silent detonation printing its leaping shadow across the cement floor and up the board wall, where a few tools still hung from the pegs. Now the humming was very clear. I directed my gaze toward the circular thermometer hanging from the beam which ran above the Buick's hood, and when the light bloomed again, I was able to read the temperature easily. 54 degrees Fahrenheit. Not great, but not terrible either. It was mostly when the temperature in Shed B dropped below 50 that you had to worry. 54 wasn't a bad number at all. Still, it was best to play it safe. We'd drawn a few conclusions about the Buick over the years, established a few rules, but we knew better than to trust any of them very far. Another of those bright, soundless flashes went off inside the Buick, and then there was nothing for almost a full minute. Ned never budged. I'm not sure he even breathed. "Is it over?" he asked at last. "Wait," I said. We gave it another 2 minutes, and when there was still nothing, I opened my mouth to say we might as well go back and sit down. The Buick had exhausted its supply of fireworks for tonight. Before I could speak, there was a final monstrous flash, a wavering tendril of light like a spark from some gigantic cyclotron shot outward and upward from the Buick's rear passenger window. It rose on a jagged diagonal to the back corner of the shed, where there was a high shelf loaded with old boxes, mostly filled with hardware oddments. These lit up a pallid, somehow eldritch yellow, as if the boxes were filled with lighted candles instead of orphan nuts, bolts, screws, and springs. The hum grew louder, rattling my teeth and actually seeming to vibrate along the bridge of my nose. And then it quit. So did the light. To our dazzled eyes, the interior of the shed now looked pitch black instead of just gloomy. The Buick was only a hulk with rounded corners and furtive gleams which marked the chrome facings around its headlights. Shirley let out her breath in a long sigh and stepped back from the window where she had been watching. She was trembling. Archie slipped an arm around her shoulders and gave her a comforting hug. Phil, who had taken the window to my right, said, "No matter how many times I see it, boss, I never get used to it." "What is it?" Ned asked. His awe seemed to have wound 10 or 12 years off his face and turned him into a child younger than his sister's. "Why does it happen?" "We don't know," I said. "Who else knows about it?" "Every trooper who's worked out of Troop D over the last 20-plus years. Some of the motor pool guys know. The county road commissioner, I think." "Jameson?" Huddy said. "Yeah, he knows. And the Statler Township Chief of Police, Sid Brownell. Beyond that, not many." We were walking back to the bench now, most of us lighting up. Ned looked like he could use a cigarette himself, or something. Big knock of whiskey, maybe. Inside the barracks, things would be going back to normal. Steph Colucci would already be noting an improvement in her radio reception, and soon the DSS dish on the roof would be receiving again. All the scores, all the wars, and 6 home shopping stations. If that wouldn't make you forget about the hole in the ozone layer, then by God, nothing would. "How could folks not know?" Ned asked. "Something as big as this? How could it not get out?"
"It's not so big," Phil said. "I mean, it's a Buick, son. A Cadillac? Now that would be big.
Some families can't keep secrets, and some families can," I said. "Ours can. Tony Shane Dinks called that meeting in the country way 2 nights after the Buick came in and Annis disappeared, mostly to make sure we would. Tony briefed us on any number of things that night. Annis's sister, of course, how we were going to take care of her and how we were supposed to respond to her until she cooled down. If she ever did, I wasn't aware of it," Huddy said. "And how we were to handle any reporters if she went to the press." There had been 12 troopers there that night, and with the help of Huddy and Phil, I managed to name most of them. Ned wouldn't have met all of them face to face, but he'd probably heard the names at his dinner table, if his dad talked shop from time to time. Most troopers do. Not the ugly stuff, of course. Not to their families. The spitting and cursing and bloody messes on the highway. But there's funny stuff, too. Like the time we got called out because this Amish kid was roller skating through downtown Statler holding on to the tail of a galloping horse and laughing like a loon. Or the time we had to talk to the guy out on the Culverton Road who'd done a snow sculpture of a naked man and woman in a sexually explicit position. "But it's art," he kept yelling. We tried to explain that it wasn't art to the neighbors. They were scandalized. If not for a warm spell and a storm of rain, we probably would have wound up in court on that one. I told Ned about how we dragged the tables into a big hollow square without having to be asked, and how Brian Cole and Dickie Duck Elliott escorted the waitresses out and closed the doors behind them. We served ourselves from the steam tables, which had been set up at the front of the room. Later there was beer, the off-duty troopers pulling their own suds and running their own tabs, and a fug of blue cigarette smoke rising to the ceiling. Peter Quinlan, who owned the restaurant in those days, loved the chairman of the board, and a steady stream of Frank Sinatra songs rained down on us from the overhead speakers as we ate and drank and smoked and talked. Luck Be a Lady, The Autumn Wind, New York, New York, and of course My Way, maybe the dumbest pop song of the 20th century. To this day, I can't listen to it, or any Sinatra song, really, without thinking of the Country Way and the Buick out in Shed B. Concerning the Buick's missing driver, we were to say we had no name, no description, and no reason to believe the fellow in question had done anything against the law. Nothing about theft of services, in other words. Queries about Ennis were to be taken seriously and treated honestly, up to a point, anyway. Yes, we were all puzzled. Yes, we were all worried. Yes, we had put out watch-and-want bulletins, what we call W-2s. Yes, it was possible that Ennis had just pulled up stakes and moved on. Really, we were instructed to say anything was possible, and Troop D was doing its best to take care of Troop Rafferty's sister, a dear lady who was so deeply upset she might say anything. As for the Buick itself, if anyone asks about it at all, tell them it's an impound, Tony had said. No more than that. If anyone does say more than that, I'll find out who and smoke them out like a cigar. He looked around the room. His men looked back at him, and no one was stupid enough to smile. They'd been around the Sarge long enough to know that when he looked the way he did just then, he was not joking. Are we clear on this? Everyone got the scoop? A general rumble of agreement had temporarily blotted out the chairman singing, "It was a very good year." We had the scoop, all right. Ned held up a hand, and I stopped talking, which was actually a pleasure. I hadn't much wanted to revisit that long-gone meeting in the first place. What about the test that guy B.B. Roth did? All inconclusive, I said. The stuff that looked like vinyl wasn't exactly vinyl. Close, but that was all. The paint chips didn't match up to any in the automotive paints B.B. had samples of. The wood was wood, likely oak, B.B. said, but that was all he would say, no matter how much Tony pressed him. Something about it bothered him, but he wouldn't say what. Maybe he couldn't, Shirley said. Maybe he didn't know. I nodded. The glass in the windows and windshield is plain old sandwich safety glass, but not trademarked. Not installed on any Detroit assembly line, in other words. The fingerprints? I ticked them off on my own fingers. Ennis, your father, Bradley Roach. End of story. No prints from the man in the black trench coat. He must have been wearing gloves, Ned said. You'd think so, yes. Brad couldn't say for sure, but he thought he remembered seeing the guy's hands and thinking they were as white as his face. People sometimes make up details like that afterwards, though, Huddy commented. Eyewitnesses aren't as reliable as we'd like them to be. You done philosophizing? I asked. Huddy gave me a grand wave of the hand. Continue. B.B. found no traces of blood in the car, but fabric samples taken from the interior of the trunk showed microscopic traces of organic matter. B.B. wasn't able to identify any of it, and the stuff, he called it soap scum, disintegrated. Every slide he took was clear of the stuff in a week. Nothing left but the staining agent he used. Huddy raised his hand like a kid in school. I nodded to him. A week later, you couldn't see the places where those guys chipped the dashboard and the wheel to get their samples. The wood grew back like skin over a grape. Same with the lining in the trunk. If you scratched a fender with a penknife or a key 6 or 7 hours later, the scratch would be gone. It heals itself? Ned said. It can do that? Yes, Shirley said. She lit another parliament and was smoking it in quick, nervous little puffs. Your father dragooned me into one of his experiments once, got me to run the video camera. He put a long scratch down the driver's side door, right under the chrome swoop, and we just let the camera run. Came back together every 15 minutes. It wasn't anything dramatic, like something in a movie, but it was pretty damned amazing. The scratch got shallower and started to darken around the edges, like it was working to match the paint job. And finally, it was just gone. All sign of it.
"And the tires," Phil Candleton said, taking a turn. "You shoved a screwdriver into one of them, the air'd start to whoosh out just like you'd expect, only then the whoosh'd thin to a whistle, and a few seconds later that would stop too. Then out comes the screwdriver." Phil pursed his lips and made a sound, like spitting out a watermelon seed.
"Is it alive?" Ned asked. His voice was so low I could hardly hear it. "I mean, if it can heal itself."
"Tony always said it wasn't," I said. "He was vehement on the subject. Just a gadget," he used to say. "Just some kind of goddamn thingamajig we don't understand."
"Your dad thought just the opposite, and by the end, he was just as vehement as Tony had ever been. If Curtis had lived..."
"What? If he'd lived, what?"
"I don't know," I said. All at once I felt dull and sad. There was a lot more to tell, but suddenly I didn't want to tell it. I didn't feel up to it, and my heart was heavy with the prospect of it, the way your heart can grow heavy at the prospect of toil, which is necessary but hard and stupid. Stumps to pull before sundown, hay to bundle into the barn before afternoon rain.
I don't know what would have happened if he'd lived. And that's the God's honest truth.
Huddy came to my rescue.
"Your dad was bullshit about the car, Ned. I mean, bug-eyed bullshit. He was out there every spare minute, walking around it, taking pictures of it, touching it. That was what he mostly did, just touching and touching, like to make sure it was real."
"Sarge'd the same way," Arky put in.
"Not exactly," I thought, but didn't say. It had been different for Kurt. In the end, the Buick had been his in a way it had never been Tony's, and Tony had known it.
"But what about Trooper Rafferty, Sandy? Do you think the Buick..."
"Ate him," Huddy said. He spoke with dead flat certainty. "That's what I thought then. It's what I think now. It's what your dad thought, too."
"Did he?" Ned asked me.
"Well, yes. Ate him or took him away to someplace else." Again, the image of stupid work came to me. Rows of beds to be made. Stacks of dishes to be washed. Acres of hay to be scythed and carried.
"But you're telling me," Ned said, "that no scientist has ever been allowed to study that thing since Trooper Rafferty and my father found it? Ever? No physicists, no chemists? No one's ever run a spectrographic analysis?"
"Beebe was back at least once, I think," Phil said, sounding just the tiniest bit defensive. "By himself, though, without those kids he used to travel around with. He and Tony and your father wheeled some big machine in there. Maybe it was a spectrograph, but I don't know what it showed. Do you, Sandy?"
I shook my head. There was no one left to answer that question, or a lot of others. Beebe Roth died of cancer in 1998. Curtis Wilcox, who often walked around the Buick with a spiral notebook in his hands writing things down, and sometimes sketching, was also dead. Tony Shane Dinks, alias the old Sarge, was still alive, but now in his late 70s, lost in that confused twilight purgatory reserved for people with Alzheimer's disease. I remembered going to see him, along with Arky Arcanian, at the nursing home where he now lives. Just before Christmas, this was. Arky and I brought him a gold St. Christopher's medal, which a bunch of us older fellas had chipped in to buy. It had seemed to me that the old Sarge was having one of his good days. He opened the package without much trouble and seemed delighted by the medallion. Even undid the clasp himself, although Arky had to help him do it up again after he'd slipped it on. When that was finally accomplished, Tony had looked at me closely with his brows knit together, his bleary eyes projecting a parody of his old piercing glare. It was a moment when he really seemed himself. Then his eyes filled with tears, and the illusion was gone.
"Who are you, boys?" he asked. "I can almost remember."
Then, as matter-of-factly as anyone reporting the weather,
"I'm in hell, you know. This is hell."
"Ned, listen," I said. "What that meeting in the country way really boiled down to was just one thing. The cops in California have it written on the sides of some of their cruisers, maybe because their memory is a little bit faulty and they have to write it down. We don't. You know what I'm talking about?"
"To serve and protect," Ned said.
"You got it."
Tony thought that thing had come into our hands almost as a result of God's will. He didn't say it that flat out, but we understood. And your father felt the same way. I was telling Ned Wilcox what I thought he needed to hear. What I didn't tell him about was the light in Tony's eyes and in the eyes of Ned's father. Tony could sermonize about our commitment to serve and protect. He could tell us about how the men of Troop D were the ones best equipped to take care of such a dangerous res. He could even allow us how later on we might turn the thing over to a carefully chosen team of scientists, perhaps one led by B.B. Roth. He could spin all those tales, and did. None of it meant jack shit. Tony and Kurt wanted the Buick because they just couldn't bear to let it go. That was the cake, and all the rest of it was just icing. The Roadmaster was strange and exotic, unique, and it was theirs. They couldn't bear to surrender it.
"Ned," I asked, "would you know if your dad left any notebooks, spirals? They would have been like the kind kids take to school."
Ned's mouth pinched at that. He dropped his head and spoke to a spot somewhere between his knees.
"Yeah, all kinds of them, actually. My mom said they were probably diaries. Anyway, in his will, he asked that Mom burn all his private papers, and she did."
"I guess that makes sense," Huddy said. "It jives with what I know about Kurt and the old Sarge, at least."
Ned looked up at him.
Huddy elaborated.
"Those two guys distrusted scientists. You know what Tony called them? Death's crop dusters. He said their big mission in life was to spread poison everywhere, telling people to go ahead, eat all they wanted, that it was knowledge and it wouldn't hurt them, that it would set them free."
He paused. "There was another issue, too."
"What issue?" Ned asked.
"Discretion," Huddy said. "Cops can keep secrets, but Kurt and Tony didn't believe scientists could. Look how fast those idiots crop-dusted the atomic bomb all around the world," I heard Tony say once. "We fried the Rosenbergs for it, but anyone with half a brain knows the Russians would have had the bomb in 2 years anyway. Why? Because scientists like to chat. That thing we've got out in Shed B may not be the equivalent of the A-bomb, but then again, it might. One thing's for sure. It isn't anybody's A-bomb as long as it's sitting out back under a piece of canvas."
I thought that was just part of the truth. I've wondered from time to time if Tony and Ned's father ever really needed to talk about it. I mean, on some late weekday evening when things at the barracks were at their slowest, guys cooping upstairs, other guys watching a movie on the VCR and eating microwave popcorn. Just the two of them downstairs from all of that, in Tony's office with the door shut. I'm not talking about maybe or kinda or sorta. I mean, whether or not they ever spoke the flat-out truth. There's not anything like this anywhere, and we're keeping it.
I don't think so. Because really, all they would have needed to do was to look into each other's eyes, to see that same eagerness, the desire to touch it and pry into it. Hell, just to walk around it. It was a secret thing, a mystery, a marvel. But I didn't know if the boy could accept that. I knew he wasn't just missing his father. He was angry at him for dying. In that mood, he might have seen what they did as stealing,
And that wasn't the truth, either. At least not the whole truth.
By then, we knew about the light quakes, I said. Tony called them dispersal events. He thought the Buick was getting rid of something, discharging it like static electricity. Issues of discretion and caretaking aside, by the end of the 70s, people in Pennsylvania, and not just us, but everyone, had one very big reason not to trust the scientists and the techies.
3 mile, Ned said.
Yes. Plus, there's more to that car than self-healing scratches and dust repellent.
Quite a bit more.
I stopped. It seemed too hard. Too much.
Go on, tell him, Arky said. He sounded almost angry, a pissed-off band leader in the gloaming. You told him all this that don't mean shit. Now you tell him the rest.
He looked at Huddy, then Shirley. Even 1988, yeah, even that part.
He paused, sighed, looked at Shed B.
Too late to stop now, Sarge.
I got up and started across the parking lot. Behind me, I heard Phil say,
No, let him go, kid. He'll be back.
That's one thing about sitting in the big chair. People can say that and almost always be right. Barring strokes, heart attacks, and drunk drivers, I guess. Barring acts of what we mortals hope is God. People who sit in the big chair, who have worked to get there and worked to stay there, never say, oh, fuck it, and go fishing. No, us big chair folks continue making the beds, washing the dishes, baling the hay, doing it the best we can. Oh, man, what would we do without you, people say. The answer is that most of them would go on doing whatever the hell they want, same as always. Going to hell in the same old handbasket.
I stood at the roll-up door of Shed B, looking through one of the windows at the thermometer. It was down to 52. Still not bad. Not terrible, anyway, but cold enough for me to think the Buick was going to give another shake or two before settling down for the night. No sense spreading the tarp back over it yet, then. We'd likely just have to do it again later on.
It's winding down. That was the received wisdom concerning the Roadmaster. The gospel, according to Shane Dinks and Wilcox. Slowing like an unwound clock, wobbling like an exhausted top, beeping like a smoke detector that can no longer tell what's hot. Pick your favorite metaphor from the bargain bin. And maybe it was true. Then again, maybe it wasn't. We knew nothing about it, not really. Telling ourselves we did was just a strategy we used so we could continue living next door to it without too many bad dreams. I walked back to the bench, lighting another cigarette, and sat down between Shirley and Ned. I said, Do you want to hear about the first time we saw what we saw tonight? The eagerness I saw on his face made it a little easier to go on.